This is the BBC.
It's the festive season, and we hope you enjoy this serving of From Our Own Correspondent, which was broadcast on Radio 4 on Saturday, the 24th of December. It's introduced by Kate Adey.
Hello. Tasty morsels for Christmas Eve from our correspondents, but it's not all about food. In Spain's Catalan heartland, anger simmers and the government serves up a renewed charm offensive. From Pune, we hear the secret recipe of a very special biscuit made in India by way of Shropshire and Lancashire. In Russia, the 1990s were frequently wild and violent, with an increasingly red-faced Boris Yeltsin at the helm. But now we're being invited to rethink those years. And we're in Paris, the city of lights. Literally, they're everywhere at this time of year, twinkling their magic through the grey and polluted skies. If you're a refugee fleeing a war zone, you wouldn't think that Somalia, with its reputation for civil war, Islamic militant violence and pirates, would be an obvious destination of choice. But in the northwestern region, which broke away from the rest of the country 25 years ago and declared itself the Republic of Somaliland, life is more peaceful. Somaliland is not recognised internationally as an independent state, but it's now become a refuge for people fleeing wars in the Middle East, as Mary Harper, a regular visitor there, has been finding out.
In the far-flung town of Burao, where nomads are losing livestock to a devastating drought, I see signs displaying pictures of dental disasters. Mouths with wildly crooked, discoloured teeth. Gaps where others are missing. All miraculously transformed into sparkly white Hollywood smiles. Above these images are the words Syrian dentist. It's the same back in the capital Hargeisa. Every time I visit the place, I notice something new. The multi-story malls and hotels, the Saudi fast food chain. But this time, most of all, it's the Syrian dentists. It's prayer time in the next-door mosque as I step into a building advertising its dental services. A young Somali woman stands behind a counter, displaying toothbrushes, floss and other accoutrements of oral health. After prayers, a Syrian man with an open face and a green T-shirt invites me into his consulting room. There's a modern white dental chair with blue plastic cushions. Posters on the wall show cross-sections of teeth and gums. A glass-fronted wooden cabinet displays neat rows of drills, picks, forceps and other worrying-looking implements. On the side of a sink sits a cast of the inside of somebody's mouth. "My name is Hossam," says the dentist. "I come from Aleppo." I ask him how on earth he ended up here in Somaliland. He explains there'd been no point going to Turkey, Lebanon or Europe because of the difficulty for refugees to find work suited to their skills. "I went online," Hossam says. "I googled places that don't have dentists. The first one that came up was Mogadishu. I went there with my wife and baby without knowing a single soul, only to discover it was like Aleppo. There was one difference. My earnings trebled." Then he heard that there was more safety and other Syrians in Hargeisa and moved here. "We have a small community," he goes on, "doctors, dentists and engineers." Later I meet another dentist, this time from Damascus. He has a long, sad face. "I remember a top United Nations man warning that Syria would become the next Somalia. And now I'm here, of all places." He looks me in the eye. "You're British, aren't you? Your people don't want us, but Somalis do." And it's true, I didn't meet a single Somali who wished away the Syrians or the Yemenis. Local people told me how, during the civil war, many Somalilanders sought refuge across the sea in Yemen. Others went to Syria and rebuilt their lives there. Then the world turned upside down and people started coming the other way. "The wars in Syria and Yemen are unfortunate," says a Somali friend, as we speed along a freshly tarmacked road linking Somaliland's capital to the coast. "But in some ways, those conflicts have been good for Somalis. They've brought us people with skills we do not have. This smooth and amazing road, for instance, was built by Syrian refugees." "And if you want the best meal in town," he said, go to a Yemeni place. These Yemeni restaurants aren't much to look at with their greasy tablecloths and smoky walls, but the sizzling beans in the battered tin dish are absolutely delicious, as is the huge circular flatbread cooked on a giant hot plate, spread with fresh vegetables, spices and eggs, then wrapped up into a scrumptious parcel. We named our restaurant Happy Yemen, says Faiz, the owner who tells me he worked as an English teacher back home. But there's nothing happy about Yemen now. The restaurant workers tell me they had no problem setting up business in Somaliland. We have to have a local partner, they explain, and, like everywhere else in the world, money talks. But the Somalilanders have really welcomed us. They've lived through war, and now they want to share their peace with us. My belly is completely full, but a teenage waiter insists I have something special from home, a Yemeni dessert. It's presented in a stemmed glass bowl, pureed fruit, decorated with nuts and chopped apples. As I eat the pudding, my mind drifts back to the Syrian dentist from Aleppo. I wish you spoke Arabic, he told me, instead of us having to communicate through your kind Somali friend who speaks my language. Because the emotion of what I'm saying is lost, and I want you to feel it. He sighed. I want you to know that Aleppo is always on my mind and in my heart. Aleppo will always be my home.
Mary Harper. It's been a year of important referendums in Europe. Now, in northeast Spain, the nationalists of Catalonia are planning to hold one of their own next year, as a precursor, hopefully, to breaking away from the rest of the country. But not all Catalans support the independence project, and the government in Madrid is completely opposed to it, leading to political tension and legal conflict. Guy Hedgeco went to the Catalan Highlands, a stronghold of the call for independence.
Nestled in the foothills of the Pyrenean Mountains, the small town of Berga has a stunning setting. Surrounded by rolling fields and rocky hills, a cream-coloured cliff towers behind it. But this idyllic-looking spot in the Catalan interior harbours a simmering anger, with many of its people determined for their region to break away from the Spanish state. That separatist feeling can be seen occasionally on Berga's tidy streets. The words "Freedom for Catalonia" have been graffitied on one wall near the town centre. "Democracy doesn't make us free," reads another. This is the heartland of Catalan separatism. Geographically, Andorra and Marseille are nearer than Madrid, the capital of a country that many here don't feel they belong to. In November, Berga briefly became the focus of the ongoing conflict between Catalonia and the rest of Spain. The young mayor of the town, Montse Venturós, was arrested one morning in her home after she had failed to appear in court. She had been summoned for violating electoral laws after hanging the red and yellow striped Catalan independence flag from the town hall during two recent election campaigns. She was released after a few hours, but news of the incident spread like wildfire throughout that day, suddenly making the little-known Venturós a symbol of the separatist movement. Activists staged demonstrations around the region as messages of support poured in from fellow politicians, who depicted this as yet another attempt by Spain to repress Catalan culture. "We want independence because we want to create a new country. We want to do so from the ground up," Venturós tells me when I speak to her in the town hall. "We want full sovereignty," she says, "and to be able to exercise the right to decide what we want as people." Venturós is a member of the Popular Unity Candidacy, or CUP. Over the last year or so, the support of this small anti-capitalist party has enabled the nationalist Catalan government to hold a majority in the regional parliament. The regional government also claims it has a mandate to push ahead with a plan to break away from Spain. That broad pro-independence front is now planning a binding referendum on secession next autumn. Ideally, it wants a Scotland-style vote, with the blessing of the central government. But that's almost impossible in Spain, where the Conservative administration of Mariano Rajoy sees any such referendum as illegal, as well as a threat to the country's unity. Catalans have several grievances. They say their wealthy region pays out in taxes much more than it receives back in investment from Madrid, meaning that infrastructure, such as their rail service, is underfunded. But there's also a broader problem. The rest of Spain doesn't understand us very well. one woman in Berga tells me. We try to have a dialogue and explain things, but they just don't understand. One recent example of that was when the Constitutional Court in Madrid decided that a ban on bullfighting, which had been introduced in Catalonia 5 years earlier, should be reversed. Catalonia, the court ruled, shouldn't be allowed to take such decisions, and magistrates in Madrid have struck down a number of other laws created by the Catalan Parliament. Many older Catalans have more bitter complaints. They remember the Franco dictatorship, when the region's culture and language were repressed, and they claim little has changed since. For many other Catalans, that's a ridiculous notion, and support for the separatist cause is not always as passionate elsewhere in Catalonia as it is in Berga. Polls show people are split down the middle on the issue, but the tough, some would say inflexible stance of the Spanish government is seen as having driven many Catalans to the secessionist cause. While staging a referendum on independence is anathema to Rajoy, in recent weeks, having formed a new government, he seems to have come round to the idea of reaching out to Catalans rather than threatening them with the law. Several new government appointments suggest a more conciliatory approach, and Madrid has promised to study the nationalists' complaints, although not their referendum plan. It's hard to know if this new charm offensive will work. For the likes of Montse Venturós and many of those in the Catalan interior whose hearts are set on independence, it's too little too late. One elderly man, who was born in 1940, at the start of the dictatorship, tells me, "This is my land, and my land is Catalonia, not Spain. What happened is that we were invaded." As he speaks, behind him, outside Berga Town Hall, the independence flag still hangs defiantly.
Guy Hedgeco. Britain's long relationship with India hasn't always been a happy one, full of understanding, but there are certain tastes we share. Naturally, food springs to mind, though in this case I'm not referring to our love of curry and poppadoms. There are recipes that have gone the other way, and some Indians can't get enough of them. Melissa van der Klucht was fortunate enough to taste some examples fresh from the oven.
A sweet buttery aroma is wafting out of the bakery. It's only 7:30 in the morning, but a queue is already forming down the street in this leafy quarter of Pune, one of India's biggest industrial cities. Most of the customers have come for one thing, the Shrewsbury biscuits. They have been baked on the same premises by the Kayani family for four generations, and their recipe is famous from Delhi to Bangalore. Behind an antiquated counter, half a dozen staff are furiously parceling up each order and tying boxes with string. "I live in Mumbai," says one lady over the din, as she attempts to elbow her way to the till. "You can't get anything like them there. I always take some biscuits back with me." By midday, they're almost sold out. Rustam Kayani and his uncle, Saurabh, who now run the business, close the door for their lunch break, and quiet suddenly descends. "We make around 300 kilos a day," says Rustam, as he counts up a drawer full of rupee notes, "and we sell every single one." "Even a rush on the bakery's Christmas puddings doesn't alter the appetite for their biscuits," he says. Although to the untrained eye, the Shrewsbury biscuit appears to be a plain shortbread, he insists it is quite different to the centuries-old recipe brought to India by the British and named after the Shropshire town. "It's the butter and water of Pune that makes it special," he adds. "I've tried making it all over the world, and it doesn't turn out the same." He comes from an old Parsi family that fled Iran a century ago. They were among those to settle and start up popular Iranian-style cafes around Mumbai and the hot weather retreat of Pune. But now their numbers are dwindling. In the 1950s, there were still 350 Irani cafes. Only a few dozen survive. "My grandfather travelled to Pakistan on camelback," says Rustam. "Then he got on a ship to Bombay. It took a month in those days. He always said to me, 'You are so lucky.' He faced bandits and some of them didn't make it. He was just 7 at the time." The original Kayani brothers opened the bakery on East Street in the abandoned British cantonment of Pune in 1955. A menu advertising Madeira cake and vanilla sponge boasts, "We have no branches." "The shop floor is an old ballroom," says Saurabh, pointing to the marble tiles, "and the kitchens were part of an English hotel." Saurabh is now in his 60s and has been working here since he was 10. For the first 2 months, There was not a single customer, he recalls. It was an area where Indians had rarely been welcome. People said my father and uncle had gone crazy and would ask us, why have you opened this bakery here? The street once bustled with competing Parsi restaurants, but now it's lined with modern sandwich chains. Many Parsis have married outside the community or have moved abroad to study and work. It's in us Parsis to be nomadic, Saurabh shrugs. Rustam was a musician in a rock band in Europe for several years, but promised his uncle he would return. The family recipe for the Shrewsbury biscuit remains unchanged. 1/3 butter and the rest flour and sugar. A small bespectacled man, who in his own youth was a big Beatles fan, Saurabh says that the long hours keep him thin, but he points at his teeth. The dentist says I must stop eating all these sweet things. He leads the way from the shop front, lined with glass cake cabinets, into a warren of kitchens. A chef has been working since dawn, slicing through pats of butter. White clouds of flour hang in the storeroom, where 150 sacks are sifted weekly. The afternoon's batches of biscuits are being placed into 2 wood-fired ovens. Saurabh points to a new gas oven. I'm not interested, he says. The taste it makes is very bland. No matter what you add, even lychee and cardamom, you don't get the same smoky flavour. In pride of place is a still-operational mixing machine bought by the family in Bolton in England in 1958. Customers want us to keep the bakery exactly this way, says Rustam, as he prepares to reopen the shop doors. He and his uncle have no plans for expansion. Our regulars come from all over the world and like the nostalgia. Each time they say, please don't change a thing.
Melissa van der Klugt. Barack Obama has less than a month to go of his presidency. He plans, as he put it, on developing a whole new generation of talent. Others will spend many hours praising or criticizing his legacy. One thing he will eventually leave behind, as every president since Herbert Hoover in the 1930s has, is a presidential library and museum, including papers, records, and collections. That's not been the practice in Russia until now. In the Urals, Andrew Dixon came across a new presidential museum which took him back in time.
The statue on the plinth looks half familiar. His tie is unknotted, his hands are in his pockets. He appears to saunter in a purposeful sort of way. On a bright winter morning, he looks like a mafia boss out for an easy Sunday stroll. The label below him is in blocky, larger-than-life Cyrillic capitals. Yeltsin, it reads. Say that surname to many people in Russia and you'll get a shrug in return, more likely an eye roll. Boris Yeltsin isn't a popular figure these days. Many people prefer to forget the period when he became Russia's first president in 1990. The 90s were a rocky decade for Russia. The experiment called the Soviet Union had finally been taken off life support. Shocked by exposure to free market capitalism, the economy went into cardiac arrest. Democratic reforms were botched. Organised crime and corruption had never had it so good. Russians have a name for this period, the Wild 90s. For those of us watching goings-on from a safe distance, President Yeltsin looked pretty wild himself. Beetroot-faced, as if permanently on the end of a long night out. Think of Yeltsin and you think of his fondness for conducting marching bands without warning, or of Bill Clinton's story that the Russian president, apparently completely legless, once tried to escape from the White House and hail a cab on Pennsylvania Avenue. But the Yeltsin Center here in Ekaterinburg in the Urals has been asking Russians to reconsider the 90s and the man himself. Opened late last year by President Putin and Prime Minister Medvedev, this sleek, futuristic-looking building is part museum, part interactive time travel capsule. It was built at a cost of nearly 5 billion rubles, paid for by the state and by businesses and associates of the Yeltsin family. The concept behind the centre, perhaps surprisingly, is American, designed to resemble the presidential libraries that have commemorated every US leader since Herbert Hoover. Ex-President Medvedev will eventually have a centre of his own, as will President Putin, if he ever decides to step down. Inside, the Yeltsin Centre is quite an experience. The cafe is named 1991, the year Yeltsin faced down a military coup. The dessert menu features recipes by Nainia Yeltsin, the first lady. In the museum itself, An introductory section guides you through 20th century history, interspersed with cute childhood pictures from the Yeltsin archive. Even at the age of 7, that grin is unmistakable. Overall, the collection has some 30,000 objects. You can stroll through a mock-up of a Moscow apartment where Swan Lake plays on a loop on TV, as it did during the attempted coup. In the section on the conflict in Chechnya, you can gaze through bullet holes onto images of war victims. The metaphor that we aren't perhaps being given the full picture about Yeltsin's rule is difficult to resist. The museum's curators insist their version of history is honest and objective. Not everyone agrees. But is it working, this attempt to persuade Russians to think again about the wild 90s? The Yeltsin Center was packed when I visited, and one man I spoke to who remembered those years said it had moved him to tears. Other people, particularly millennials for whom the 90s was their childhood, simply shrugged. One woman in her late 20s told me, "I'm too young to remember it well, and even so, I know it was a dark time." Later, I asked the Russian journalist and critic Konstantin Milchin for his view. He shrugged. "Every 10 years, Russian history is completely reinvented," he said. I asked him what Putin's own presidential museum will contain, if the time ever comes. He offered the faintest of smiles in reply. A popular instant messaging service in Russia right now is called Telegram. Millennials are particularly obsessed. They say Telegram's attraction is that it's very secure and can't be hacked. My hunch is there's another reason. One of the app's more playful features is that it allows you to send your friends custom-made photos and icons. Pop stars, cute babies, things like that. Before I left Ekaterinburg, someone sent me a set of Telegram stickers of my own. The theme, rather to my surprise, was Yeltsin. Yeltsin making the V for victory sign. Yeltsin making a power salute. Yeltsin banging his fist on his presidential desk. Courtesy of an instant messaging app, Russia's first president lives again. If you choose to, you can communicate entirely in Yeltsin's.
Andrew Dixon. Before it became the city of love, Paris was long known as La Ville Lumière, the city of light. The name dates from its role in the Age of Enlightenment, and somewhat more prosaically, because it was one of the first European cities to adopt gas street lighting. Anyone who's been to Paris recently can testify to the city's love of lights, especially during this festive period. And they're becoming more environmentally friendly. Already, public buildings use only green electricity, and by 2020, 85% of the streetlights are supposed to have switched to more efficient LED bulbs. Joanna Robertson says with the grey winter skies and the city's frequent problems with dangerous pollution levels, Paris needs its magical fairy tale lights like never before.
It's 6 a.m, winter dark, and the concierge are beginning to emerge. Heavy entrance doors are hauled wide open, bins clatter out onto pavements. There's a smell of polish and warm soap suds, a scrubbing of mosaic-tiled floors, a rubbing of brasses. And behind each shadowy, labouring form, the glittering magic of a myriad coloured lights winking out from pretty Christmas trees set back in the gloom of hallways. Through the waking city, the River Seine flows swiftly, its glowing embankment lamps, softly floodlit bridges, and the red port green starboard of a passing barge are all reflected in the dusky water, where swans, cormorants, seagulls and mallards ride the swell together, waiting for the only light that interests them, the deepening orange dawn. Rush hour traffic shimmers by, white in one direction, red in the other. Bus stops beam, optimistically radiant in a stylish signage code of vibrant colours. Egg yolk yellow, mint green, Yves Klein blue, cherry pink, depending on the number of the bus route. Giant Roman numerals stand out jet black bold against the luminous twin faces of the Musée d'Orsay's great clocks. A motorcade of police vans blares by in a dazzling peacock blue streak of sirens, while just across the river, in the quiet dark of the Tuileries Gardens, potent microlights dart low, haphazardly, between the bare trees, attached to the collars of sophisticated city dogs out on morning walks. As day breaks, the multiple scattering rhythms and pulses of coloured light that transform the Montparnasse Tower, visible across the entire city, from dreary high-rise office block to a sashaying belly-dancing seductress, subtly fade to bide their time till dusk. At the city's great stations, Parisians board trains or greet friends in an ambience of gaudy red and white festive lighting blended with loudspeaker-streamed Mozart. At Christmas, it's the magic flute, drowning out all useful information announcements. On Place Saint-Germain, the fabled left-bank cafes of the existentialists are garlanded night and day with luxuriant, expensive lights on a boulevard now famous for high-end fashion and design rather than books or intellectual debate. Trees are hung with great clusters of sparkling white lights as far as the eye can see, or decorated with a filigree of tiny silver bulbs, transforming wood and branch into gently effervescing flutes of champagne, bubbles winking at the brim. The dwindling light of late afternoon triggers sensors on the Eiffel Tower, and within minutes, its bolted iron girders are wrapped in a signature weightless nighttime golden cloak of glory, made up of 336 projectors of unromantic, high-pressure yellow-orange sodium lamps. Throughout the evening, 20,000 more bulbs bring the tower to life in a radiant, scintillating hourly miracle of a light show. On the Place de la Concorde, La Grande Roue, the big wheel, dazzles with dancing, flashing razzmatazz red, white and blue like a fantastical spinning target board. Seen from the top, the city is a vast, glittering web beneath a lustrous full moon, pale in comparison. At the foot of the wheel, the Champs-Élysées begins, shimmering with 800,000 LED light bulbs, its first half mile become a raucous fairground of a Christmas market. The sickly scent of hot sugared fritters mingles with the myriad perfumes and colognes of the crowds of international tourists thronging the avenue. At the circular halfway point, known worldwide as the Golden Triangle of Luxury Shopping, poised between the pulsating wheel and the coolly floodlit Arc de Triomphe, a ring of searchlights beams up, crisscrossing the night sky in an aerial sword dance of translucent silver. The opulent boutiques of the great French couturiers nestle behind trees smothered in lights, glittering like heavy diamond fruits. Down near the Comédie Française, where Paris was first lit up by gaslight in 1829, 220 sparkling Christmas trees and hundreds of light displays lure shoppers towards the Rue Saint-Honoré, where row upon row of elaborate Baroque-style chandeliers evoke a Versailles decadence. Turn into the Place Vendôme, an oasis of elegant beauty, its gilded 18th-century street lamps twinned with Christmas trees studded in glimmering tawny gold. At 1 a.m, the Eiffel Tower sparkles brilliantly for the last time before switching off for the night, and by 2 a.m. the lights are off all round the city, from the Champs-Élysées to public monuments to department store windows. Even the streetlights are dimmed, and the waterbirds sleep on the River Seine as a handful of stars begin to shine.
Joanna Robertson. Now we switch off this edition and I'll be back on New Year's Eve with more illumination from our own correspondents. Do join me. Goodbye.